We present My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Tryon and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is Antonia Fraser.
Thank you very much. Today's battle will be between Dilys Powell and Frank Muir on one side, and Irene Thomas and Dennis Norden on the other. First, a round to probe their vocabulary. Can you, Frank, tell me, or hazard a guess, at the meaning of the following word? Macaronic.
Yes.
Good.
It's called 18th century word, isn't it? There are two meanings to this that I know of. One is, it means foppish. The macaronis were the fops who'd been to Italy and brought back and introduced macaroni into this country in about 1760. And so a foppishly dressed would be dressed in a macaronic style. There's also macaronic verse, which being more literary is probably the one you want, isn't it? Which is a mixture of Latin, usually Latin, and your own language to humorous effect.
I think I'm going to definitely give you 2 marks. I did want the second meaning, really. Macaronic, I think, generally refers to literature. For example, Maius Wordus would be a macaronic way of referring to this excellent programme. But it was nice to hear about the fops as well. Irene, numbles.
N-U-M-B-E-L-S.
No, N-U-M-B-L-E-S.
Oh dear, oh dear. Sounds like something you find inside a dead animal, doesn't it?
It does.
Yes.
Keep on.
Is it the intestines of a dead stag?
You are absolutely brilliant.
Oh. Is that where eating humble pie comes from?
You're even more brilliant and you're going to get a bonus mark.
Well, I've got that try it sometime.
Dilys. Pragmatic.
Pragmatic. P-R-G. Pragmatic is something you attempt to do. It's an experiment, a trial, a practical trial.
Well, it often is held to mean that these days. The first meaning of pragmatic was not so pleasant. It meant officious and meddlesome, but it's come to mean learning practically from lessons. But that was very good. 2 marks. Dennis, now first of all tell me in your own words, and then if you can, illustrate it. A discobulos.
Now, I'll give you some of my own words now. Now, it only has one meaning for me, and I can't illustrate it because I can't draw anything where the man isn't wearing a tie, because I can't do necks. And the discobulos, as far as I remember, was that Greek statue of the chap who looks like he's, you know, who the hell served me porridge? And he's getting rid of the plate. You're throwing the discus.
Absolutely right. Two.
Now, I can't illustrate, as I say, because he happens to have very little arm. If he had a tie, I could give you a very good likeness.
Oh, just wear the tie.
Now, before we go into round two, here, Frank and Dennis, are the quotations you were given for the last round. Frank, yours is Henry IV, Part 1, and yours, Dennis, is For Whom the Bell Tolls. Now, a round entitled Four of a Kind. What do the following quartets have in common? Frank, a ruffler, a palliard, a jarkman, and a Tomah Bedlam.
Tomah Bedlam was a vagrant beggar in the Tudor and Elizabethan time, so-called because madmen, so-called, in Bedlam, in Bethlehem Hospital, were allowed to beg. So, well, on some days, professional beggars pretended to be from Bedlam, and they were called Tomah Bedlams.
Absolutely right.
Palliard was a chap with sores, who was carried around in straw on a litter, begging. Also one of the 9 vagrants. So, might the others be similar?
Yes, what they all have in common is that they are all beggars and vagabonds, and they were all mentioned in Shakespeare. A Jartman would be a very awkward vagabond to encounter if we were about to get married.
Ah, a bogus clergyman.
Exactly.
For marrying heiresses.
Exactly. And a ruffler, in fact, is a bogus war veteran who covers himself with bogus scars. But that was very good, 2 marks. Irene. Suck, squeeze, bang and blow. What do these 4 terms have in common?
Suck, as in S-U-C-K.
Yes.
Squeeze, bang and blow. Well, I suppose they're all terms you could apply to orchestral players. They all suck, squeeze, bang and blow something, don't they?
Could be a one-man band again.
Would indeed.
Does it all at once.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes. With bells on his hat.
Well, I think that's perfectly logical. But in fact, there is an area where these 4 terms, they are slang for 4 processes.
Oh, I see. Yes. Well... Oh, you say I'll ring you on the blower, don't you, for a telephone. Is it anything technical like that?
Yes.
Modern technology. But I think the telephone is modern technology. I'm sure some other people do.
Glass
blower. Oh, dear. Computer language, perhaps.
Not exactly. They really follow from each other. I tell you what they are. They're the... For the words, the sort of slang for the cycle of a 4-stroke internal combustion engine.
Fine. I was only testing you.
More formally known as induction, compression, ignition, and exhaust.
Thank you.
It's all relaxed.
Thank you.
Dillis, what have these 4 words got in common? A white horse, a red horse, a black horse, and a pale horse.
Pale horse is a biblical horse. He comes with the, the last world. The 4 horses of the apocalypse.
Yes.
In that film, which you're all too young to have seen. I'm not.
With the script by St. John the Divine, chapter 6. Well done. Dennis. An inverted Fräulein.
Fräulein, yeah.
A bamboo slash, a wally, and a double happiness with long pimples.
Do you know what they... A double happiness with long pimples. Do you know what they look? They look like the sort of chapter notes... For a sort of Leslie Thomas novel, you know, in the first chapter is about this Fräulein's hanging upside down, the bamboo splashes when the Virgin soldiers are in the jungle, you know, they do a lot of that, and so on. It may surprise you to know that I have not the faintest idea what double happiness with long pimples is. There seems to be retribution there. Something.
Is it something to do with a game, perhaps?
A game, yes?
Yes.
All right. I'll play my wally, and you come back with double happiness with long pimples, and you trump my bamboo slash.
It is to do with the game. They're the types of rubber surfacing upon table tennis bats.
Ah.
And you'll be happy to hear that they're authorised for use by the International Table Tennis Federation.
Well, I'm very relieved to hear that.
Yeah. Now for a round of second lines. Can you recite the first, that is the opening line of the poem, whose second line is as follows? Frank, ere slumber's chain has bound me.
It's a song, isn't it?
You may sing.
I may not, in fact, because I don't know it. Ah, a little voice says, how does it go?
I think it's
awesome. It's one of those dirgy ones, isn't it? I mean, sensitive ones. That goes oft in the stilly night.
You're absolutely right. An angel spoke to you, I know.
An angel sang for my right.
Oft in the stilly night, ere slumber's chain has bound me. How about giving the author for a bonus?
It's the Irishman, isn't it? Tom Moore.
Absolutely right. Thomas Moore in National Airs, Oft in the Stilly Night. And the full 4 lines are, Oft in the stilly night, ere slumber's chain has bound me, fond memory brings the light of other days around me. Irene, old time is yet a-flying.
Gather ye roses while ye may, old time is yet a-flying. And something, something, some today, tomorrow may be dying.
The rose that's the flower that's smiles so sweet today, tomorrow will be dying.
Just take the first line again in detail.
Gather ye rose buds while ye may.
Absolutely right.
Herrick?
Mm.
It is. Robert Herrick?
Yes.
Counsel to girls.
Ah.
Dillis. And his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold.
It's about the Assyrian, that is. The Assyrian came down with something
like
other.
A wolf.
Like a wolf in the fold.
Absolutely right. And the author?
Macaulay. Somebody like Macaulay. Not Macaulay, but somebody rather like Macaulay.
It is rather like Macaulay. As a matter of fact, to tell you the truth, I always think it is by Macaulay, yeah. But it ain't.
He's thinner than Macaulay, isn't he?
He's handsomer than Macaulay.
Byron.
It was. Byron, the destruction of Sennacherib. Anyhow, well done. You'll get your full complement of two. Dennis, England hath need of thee. She is a fen of stagnant waters.
Milton, thou shouldst be living at this hour.
Well done. Author?
Wordsworth.
Well done again. And if you got the...
Well, you see, it's the one where he says we are selfish men. It's the one where he's telling off England. He says that everybody in England is selfish. Extraordinary the number of times, actually, that Milton crops up in other... I bet he's the most mentioned of other poets, isn't he? I mean, you know, name two... mute and glorious, Milton.
For malt does more than Milton can
to justify the ways of God's ways to man, yeah.
Well, I was looking this up in the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. I had exactly the same thought. There are lists of mentions of Milton.
Milton, yeah.
Now for a round of miscellaneous divinations. If chiromancy is the foretelling of future events by study of the hand, and take my hand on it, it is, what would you study if you practiced the following? Frank, skyomancy.
Sky.
Skyomancy. S-C-I-O mancy.
No. It's telling the future by puddles.
You're right. Exactly.
Shadows. Shadows, madam. Shadows. It's like telling time with a sundial.
Quite right. I heard your partner helped you. Well done, Dillis. I knew your classical education would get you. 2 marks for skyomancy, which means by consultation into the shadows, looking into shadows, or possibly the shades of the dead. It can have either meaning. Irene. Astrogallomancy.
Good gracious. A-S-T-R-O or A-S-T-R-A?
A-S-T-R-A. Gallomancy.
Something to do with the stars.
Mm. So instead of doing it with the shadows, you do it with Cliff Richard by peering into Cliff Richard.
You speak for yourself. Astrogallomancy. The courses of stars or the...
If you think of the Greek for... Astragalus.
Oh, well, that didn't do Greek.
That's a fellow's name, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In fact, it's the Greek for knuckle bones and came to mean dice.
I don't know.
Because the Greeks used to throw knuckle bones as dice. So it's really using dice. Mm. Dillis, capnomancy.
Capno. It's something to do with smoke.
Terrific.
Isn't it?
It is exactly. That's what it is. If you gazed into a campfire and foretold the future. Well done. 2 marks. Dennis. Omphalomancy.
Is that O-M-P-H-A-L-O?
Yes.
Well, as with omphalos, yes?
I think so.
Yeah. Omphalos, I believe, was something to do with the Delphic Oracle. And it was the navel of the world, the tummy button of the world. And I presume there are people who go around thinking that if you look into people's tummy buttons, it'll tell you what is going to win the 3:30 next Tuesday. Well, That's not a bad way. I'm brought on that nudist beach at Brighton to go around. It's a very good excuse, actually, isn't it? So, you know, I was simply divining the future from there.
Well, you're absolutely right. It is, as it were, contemplating your own or another's navel. And it was connected with the oracle. And another way of doing it, if you don't want to go to Brighton Beach, is to look at the number of knots on the navel of a newborn child.
Oh,
that's dangerous, isn't it?
And now we come to the last round and Frank and Dennis's quotations. Frank, your quotation is Henry IV, Part 1, which is, of course, the title of a well-known play, but you don't get any marks for telling me the author.
Yes, now, I'm going to be very short now because I'm just going to use the airwaves to give a little advertisement, a little small ad, because I want to sell something. And it's far, far too expensive to put in the papers. And there's a portrait of my dear face painted by a local lady, and I wanted to sell that, and I rang up the Times, said, how much will an ad cost? And they said, £1 a line. Now, I counted the lines. God, is it 240 quid? I can't afford that sort of thing, and I've got something really marvellous to sell. So I thought if I just sort of brought it in to the conversation, the producer won't notice that it's an ad. And we keep chickens, you see, and I got very worried about them rushing around the orchard and felt that I should really think about this and have a more systematic way of looking after chickens. And it seemed to me one of the difficult things was picking up the eggs and finding them. So I got some square boxes and I made two holes in the bottom and a larger hole in the top and thrust a chicken into a box each. So their legs came out and they could run around, you see. And they could feed because their neck came through the top. But as the eggs dropped, you see, they'd be held by the box. And then once a week, all I had to do was to go around and put my hand in the box. And it wasn't a success. I shouldn't have put my hand in the box to start with. A, they didn't lay because they were so terrified at this box they were carrying around. And B, although they box collected the eggs, or would have done if they laid any, it also collected everything else. But I got rid of the boxes, and then a friend said to me, you must be careful of foxes because the fox population is growing, and they'll be wolf, they'll be after your chickens. Whatever you do in the way of a chicken house, it must be fox proof. So I made one of corrugated steel, and it was quite large, actually, and extremely heavy, with a corrugated iron bottom, no windows, because you couldn't have window in corrugated iron, and I shoved all the dozen chickens in, and I put perches about 4 foot off the ground, so that even if a fox did bite his way through the steel, he couldn't leap up and get the chickens. What happened was, of course, the chickens didn't realize it was whether it was day or night. So they laid eggs. It got so hot in there that they couldn't stand on the floor or sit down to lay. So they laid the eggs on the perches 6 foot up, which then dropped onto the corrugated iron, broke, rolled slowly down the hot metal and fried. And they got 8 very long, thin fried eggs a day, which wasn't in the contract at all. So I got rid of that. And then I decided that rather like contented cows give more and better milk, that contented chickens would give more eggs. So I ran some chicken wire round 4 apple trees in the orchard and made them a little place where they could roam around. And I got a tape recorder and played them 24 hours a day, sing along with Max, a sort of Muzak for hens. And to save them trouble, I dug little holes for them to save them scratching away, and I arranged running races for them. And it all really should have been lovely, but it didn't work for some reason. They just refused to lay. They just stared at me when I tried to organize them and talk to them and did their impressions of Frankie Howard. And they stood on one leg and gazed at me balefully with one pink eye. And then because the thing I'm doing is approaching it from an amateur fashion. If I approached it like a professional and housed them as a professional would house them, we'd get lots and lots of wonderful eggs. So I invested in this thing called a chicken ark, which is a wonderful thing. It's about 30 foot long, and it's triangular shaped, and part of it is open to the sky, so that the birds, the hens can have the fresh air. Part of it is on grass, and they go into a little cabin where it's all dark, and they can lay their eggs, and it's got a floor. And there's another little cabin where they can all sleep. It's a beautiful thing. And we've had this about a month, and it's my fourth go at providing the right environment for these chickens, and it's a beauty. They've been laying a dozen eggs every day. We've now filled up all the egg boxes in the house. We've got all the bowls are full of eggs. The shelves are lined with eggs. And last night, when we finished a little bit of supper, we had a light supper. It was egg mayonnaise and followed by an omelette, an egg custard. My wife gave a funny little whimper I hadn't heard before. And she sort of flung her knife at the ceiling, where it embedded and went boing, boing, boing. And she said, never want to see an egg again. Never want another egg in my life. I'm fed up with eggs. So I've got this lovely, full environment for hens for sale. So if you'd like to make a little note, I'll tell you all around now. Bargain for sale. Henry the Fourth, Part Worn.
Now, Dennis, let's see how you get on with For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Well, after I'd signed up for an exercise class recently, the instructor's parting words to me were, okay then, Tiger. Be here 6:30 next Tuesday and make sure you're wearing loose clothing. Well, I'm sorry to have to admit this, but I gave him one of my looks. I said, listen, lad, if I had any loose clothing, I wouldn't be needing your rotten exercises. Because you see, what I was endeavouring to cope with at the time was a physical process that tends to beset many of us who have weathered a fistful of decades. My body had begun to develop a natural immunity to being thin. And as is customary, the first symptom of that tendency towards turning avocado shape was a certain unexpected tightness of the clothing. Almost overnight, I'd begun experiencing acute sensations of what might well be described as living beyond my seams. Whenever I now decided to do up the collar button of my shirt, the whole hairless area north of my neck immediately took on the hue of shrimp cocktail. And with my trousers, what matters there were even worse. Every pair I owned had now become so strained for room, any time I was unwise enough to cross my legs unexpectedly, I found myself giving an involuntary audition for the Vienna Boys Choir. In fact, one way and another, I had to resign myself to the fact that about the only thing in my entire wardrobe that still fitted me was my umbrella. Now, where I felt the injustice of that state of affairs most keenly was in respect what had long been my two favourite items of apparel, a couple of crocodile belts that I'd picked up ridiculously cheap in Ibiza back in the days when the pound was still worth nearly 7 shillings. And the thought of having to relinquish those belts just because the holes I'd been accustomed to using in them now seemed to have healed up, well, it gnawed at me so much that when a business meeting obliged me to stay for the night at a famous Arab-owned West End hotel, I jumped at the opportunity it offered. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, what opportunity? Well, that just shows that you've never tried drilling new holes in an old belt. Because one of the first things you learn about that is that the finest instrument for doing it is a kebab skewer. And where are you likely to come across the very sharpest kebab skewers in London? In the kitchens of an Arab-owned West End hotel. Which is why, at the moment I arrived in my room, I rang for the chambermaid and asked her, gave her the two belts, asked her if she'd take them down to the chief chef and ask him if he'd kindly employ his best kebab skewer to pierce each of them a couple of times where I had indicated by means of pencil crosses. Well, looking back on it now, I do realise it would perhaps have been wiser if I'd gone down to the kitchen myself and explained. You see, because with the benefit of hindsight, I can now see that if you present a non-English speaking chef with any set of instructions, no matter what about, he's going to take that set of instructions as an indication of how you want something cooked. And never mind if the something happens to be two crocodile leather belts, because in an international hotel, they just shrug that off as some new variation of the F-plan diet. It's high fiber. So there were two things about the meal that evening that I am never likely to forget. One was the sight of the cover being taken off a solid silver serving dish to reveal two old belts nestling on a bed of chopped ice and lettuce. The other was the totally imperturbable tone of the head waiter's voice as he inquired of the assembled company, "For whom the belt holds?"
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I see from the score sheet that Frank and Dillis are the winners in this week's contest over Dennis and Irene. Goodbye.
In My Word, the chairman was Antonia Fraser. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shryan and Pete Atkin.